second to last session for the afternoon. We have Richard and Bartek to take us through that session there. And it's on the content areas under review or for review. Under review. I'm not certain who's going to lead off, if it's going to be Bartek. Richard will start. Yeah. Hey, Richard, please.
We'll be looking at the IFRS taxonomy content. This presentation will be in two parts. I'll be doing the first part, which is on the update on the common practice project, and then Bartek will carry us through the IFRS for SMEs amendments and early application.
It takes a second.
Okay, so update on the common practice project.
You can keep going as you can chat.
In our last call in February, you'd probably recall that we informed you that we would be having various internal discussions on the findings of our proposed common practice list for 2014. And subsequent to that, we have met with the technical staff and also the board review panel. Now, in starting with the technical staff, we were advised from them to look at three areas for further analysis. These three areas being technology, programming assets, including current and non-current breakdowns, and combinations of property, plant, and equipment. Now, looking at the first area, technology, which we reviewed. The technical staff were questioned by the members of the taxonomy team were questioned by the technical staff as to whether. As to whether technology should be a separate class of intangible assets, and whether it's synonymous with existing classes such as computer software, recipes, designs and prototypes, copyrights, patents, and other rights. Now, we looked further into the financial statements of companies reporting technology, and we realized that companies that disclose technology as a separate class of intangible assets do not explain what is actually included in technology. And we also looked at an illustrative example to IFRS 3, and this uses the term technology-based intangible assets. Okay, and following this, it was proposed that we change our original proposition of technology to technology-based intangible assets and propose this as a separate class of intangible assets. Sorry, I'm not sure what's going on there. Sorry about that. So we reverted from technology to technology-based intangible assets, and we proposed this as a separate class of intangible assets. And in addition to that, we also changed the original definition of technology from a class of intangible assets representing technology to a class of intangible assets representing assets based on technology. Such assets may include patented and unpatented technology, databases, as well as trade secrets. The next area that the technical staff asked us to review was programming assets. And programming assets is a concept most common to media-related activities, in particular the broadcasting sector. And it is most often presented on the face of the financial statements, and it's broken down into current and non-current parts. And the technical staff raised concerns regarding the classification of programming assets as to whether it is a class of intangible assets that was reported separately due to its significance. Following this, we had a further look at programming assets as it's presented in the financial statements. And we found out that programming assets are defined and classified separately by companies either as intangible assets, inventories, or both. And so it was proposed that we retain the proposed positioning of programming assets in the IFRS taxonomy under miscellaneous assets, thereby avoiding classification as either intangible assets or inventories. And this was done mainly to reflect diversity in practice, because the programming assets, if you were to say put it in intangible assets, then probably preparers would just associate it with intangible assets, whereas in practice it's reported as intangible assets or inventories, which is why we stuck to putting it in miscellaneous assets. And further to this, we will also seek feedback during our public consultation on this. The third area that we were asked to look at a bit more was classes of property, plant, and equipment. Now, you'll probably recall that we had identified various combinations of classes of property, plant, and equipment, three to be exact, being plant and machinery, plant and equipment, and machinery and equipment. And the technical staff made a few observations in that they pointed out that none of these combinations are defined in IFRS. These three combinations may even have the same conceptually equivalent meaning, and that existing IFRS taxonomy elements such as machinery, fixtures and fittings, or office equipment could potentially be used. And additionally, by including these combinations of property, plant, and equipment, you might give the signal that preparers should tag labels with exactly the precise matching labels, which could seem to suggest that at slight variations that we should, or they should, create extensions for them, and which is not the idea that we want to convey. And in addition to that, this technical staff also suggested that a top-down structured breakdown of classes of property, plant, and equipment within the taxonomy should be used rather than a flat list which includes many potential combinations. Following this, it was proposed that we consider analyzing reported combinations of classes of assets and liabilities in more detail as part of the Disclosure Initiative project. This is something that will be, or if and when done, will be done at a future date. And it was also proposed that we defer the proposed additional combinations of classes of property, plant, and equipment until a general analysis is performed. The technical staff also gave us a few suggestions for future common practice projects. In fact, they gave us two suggestions. The first suggestion being that we further investigate each potential common practice element before proposing it. And in order to do this, we would need to look more closely at accounting policies and related notes. And by doing this, it would ensure that the accounting meaning of proposed elements are captured and not just the label. It would also help to avoid unwarranted interpretation of accounting meaning of potential elements. And it also allows for a clearer understanding of how an element is classified and hence better positioning in the taxonomy. The second suggestion from the technical staff on improving the common practice project was that we reconsider our approach to creating documentation labels, for instance, by means of additional examples or guidance, which would help to clarify the accounting meaning of proposed elements. And if we can just add that if and when such a project is undertaken, it's very likely that it will be a separate project due to the significance and the scope of it, and will also involve other areas of the organization, including board members and education. And in addition to this, or subsequent to our meeting with technical staff, we also met with the board review panel, who Christy alluded to earlier on this morning, which consists of five board members. And we met with them on April 8th, and we presented a paper to them, the aim of which was to present the findings of the 2014 Common Practice Project, and also to discuss two specific issues which we had, being one, the use of alternative performance measures such as EBITDA and net debt, and also to discuss the use of profit and loss as a part of equity in the equity section of the statement of financial position. Now, following this meeting, the board members expressed that they had no issues concerning our proposed list of common practice elements. Regarding the use of alternative performance measures, there are currently some internal discussions among the board members about this. So they have suggested that we consider not including these for now until such discussions are finalized among themselves. Regarding the use of profit and loss as a part of the equity section of the statement of financial position, it was suggested by the members of the board that we don't include it, so we're not going to be including it as a part of our proposed elements for this year. And yeah, essentially that's the update and as to where we stand. And if there are any questions.
Tyler, you have one?
The only question I had was in relation to the treatment around our programming assets.
Yeah.
So it seems fairly clear from a human reader's analysis of the printed financial statements that you'd easily be able to determine whether those programming assets were intangible assets or inventories. But the proposal in the Exwell taxonomy is that you would not be able to get the same distinction as a computer reader.
It's the thing about the IFRS taxonomy location is that it's effectively where you find them when you're trying to navigate through the taxonomy.
Yeah.
And we do tend to say that our presentation link base, just because of the nature of our filing, is not really a presentation link base as such as a taxonomy navigation link base. So the reason for all the debate about the locations is at least in part that people might take it as a hint that you can only use it in one of those two sections. But also it's that...
I think I must disagree with the comment that you should be able to distinguish. In many cases we found that the programming assets are just a separate line, and the company doesn't say whether it's part of intangibles, part of inventories, it just as a separate line. So also I think one of the big four companies says in their financial statement, I'm not sure if yours or the others, that simply people treat programming assets as inventories or intangible assets or both, or a combination of both. And we just wanted to care for all those cases and therefore place those items completely separately. They are placed under miscellaneous assets just so that they can be moved wherever the company needs.
And in theory, it's a navigation point rather than a specific statement of what kind of asset it is anyway.
We were very careful not to define them as either or.
On that same thing, if they were intangibles and they weren't indefinite life, you would have some expected life on it, and that would kind of clue you in that they must be intangible, because inventory doesn't have a, you know.
Yeah, obviously, if you look into the notes and something, you might start analyzing it. But there are also companies that actually put both. So
yeah, it could be both. I mean, depending on how you utilize them. So
it's perfect.
Kind of share your view that this is...
went with the most common way. Most commonly, they are presented as a separate line on the face of the financial statement. Separate to inventory, separate to intangible assets. Even if they are partly intangible assets, or even if they are part of intangible assets, they are usually separated. and therefore we wanted to equally separate it in the taxonomy, thinking that it would make the use of that element.
But is this potentially going to have somebody take something that belongs in inventory, which is a current asset, and pull it out and stick it somewhere else, or stick it in never never? I mean, you have to make it current or non-current.
Well, but that's a question of the financial statement, not of the taxonomy.
I
agree.
Okay.
Lou, you wanted to make a point?
Yeah, the property, plant, and equipment, all the different members, right now they're fairly flat and not parent-childed. I think I'm glad you're leaving it till later to analyze, but when you do analyze it, I think it gets very impossible to try to make them parent-child, because some you don't know how they parent-child, plus there's duplicates. So good idea, but like Andy said, this is more a navigation way. Well, there's all my choices. It's not perfectly which are children of which parents.
The conclusion, I think, that what was pointed to us by the technical staff is that maybe we should take a look at the standard itself and the way people present our property plan equipment in general,
yeah,
not only in the taxonomy.
And we
might come to the same conclusion as you can. You already
maybe
came that there is it's impossible to do anything more than that.
And I agree with them about you don't want people thinking the label is what they need to match, but I don't think that happens a lot in real life. I got three things. The second one is, can you go back 10 slides?
And the clear answer to that is no.
Well, you can't?
Well, yeah,
well,
okay.
I'm on, it's my slide 7, but it's your slide 133, I think. Okay, if it takes a while, I'll just say what it is. The definition of technology-based intangible assets. Such assets may include patented and unpatented technology, databases, as well as trade secrets. Shouldn't say as well as technology-based trade secrets, because a trade secret could be a non-technology thing, such as to make concrete, you put water, sand, and cement. That's maybe a trade secret. Just saying. So I would suggestion instead of trade secret, say technology-based trade secret. Okay.
Took it directly from the book.
That's enough. Yeah. And then in the end, did you say EBITDA and EBIT? You're not going forward with those at this point? Okay.
That's the advice we got from the board, considering
yeah,
that there is also some papers coming to the board on the use of the...
Okay, that makes sense. That's what I was...
We've been discussing...
I would expect.
EBITDA as part of the disclosure initiative, and whether we should seek to... We got agreement that it would be permissible under IFRS, under certain circumstances, to present EBITDA on the face,
really?
But that we wouldn't seek to define it in this project. I think that is something we're going to delay to a performance reporting project, and even then I think there's different sort of senses around the board whether we should be looking to define any performance measures. That's a very topical and sensitive issue, hence why we're delaying. Well, we don't want the taxonomy to be leading.
No. Okay, that's good. Good to hear.
So on adding to their Christie's explanation, among both members have different views on this kind of non-IFRS measures. So some people are favoring, you know, to disclose this kind of all information because they are maybe good in understanding their firm position and performance, because this is the view of from the management. But the other members are thinking this is a kind of a manipulating,
yep,
their performance with some kind of artificial or good numbers, just including those numbers in calculating their some maybe EBITDA or EBIT or some adjusted some kind of performance numbers. So still we are discussing it, which direction is better. But Christy is in charge of that issue, so we'll get to the conclusion quite soon, but it'll take some time. And another thing that I'd like to add on this program, the assets, whether a technical, maybe that's intangible assets or inventory. I guess in terms of your perspective, just you make some kind of element. This program, the assets, with some big dash, long dash, this is an intangible asset. Or the programmed assets, the dash inventory. So because intangible assets are inventory are defined in specific IFRS. So actually, if they are satisfying the definition of intangibles, then they have to present that item under the intangibles. If they are meeting the inventory, then that must be, you know, presented on the inventory. So that's what I'm saying. So as you discussed, you know, that this is the standard account standard and taxonomy have different roles, you know, so maybe this kind of some kind of internet based, you know, something. It's a kind of big issue for many companies to classify which one this is. But this is quite a tricky issue in practice. But the IFRS is suggesting specific good definitions of this each, you know, class. So maybe there are some accounting firms might have a problem in classifying these kind of things. But they have to make a conclusion. So they have to make a decision whether these items are satisfying which definition in the IFRS. That's
sometimes it's a combination. Sometimes they you know, specifically avoid the definition and they say it's a combination of both.
Right.
And for the importance of the line, it's a separate line. Because usually it's a very important line for media companies.
If the some elements, some items are really difficult to classify because it's satisfying some many aspects of some class, maybe in that case, we need to amend the IFRS, maybe. So this is a kind of a good practice that will to, you know, give a good feedback to the accounting standard setters. So it's kind of interactive, you know, communication between this taxonomy and the standard setters. But if there's no problem with the IFRS, then all companies must respect the definitions all come to these classes, and the accounting firms, the smarters, must to give a good guidance on how to classify the things.
Thank you. So, the last two things from my side today. First is the IFRS for SMEs amendments, and this is just to update you on the what's coming for IFRS for SMEs. You will soon receive the taxonomy, the documents and everything. But we just wanted to take the opportunity to very quickly run you through this. As you probably know, the IFRS for SMEs were published in July 2009, and the ESB said that they would review it after 2 years. So they started that project in June 2012, so they figured that 2010 and 2011 were the 2 years. Then in June 2012, they started the review process. We first issued the request for information. Then, based on the feedback, we also issued an exposure draft in 2013. Then we also consulted that with our SME implementation group. So we have the EISB has a special group that consults the SMEs issues, and then they finalized the technical discussions in December 2014 and started the drafting process. And the amendments, the final amendments, will be published very soon, probably in 2 weeks' time. In terms of the impact of the IFRS taxonomy, obviously the impact is significant. So the review of IFRS for SMEs is about 60 pages long, I guess. So there are also changes to the presentation and disclosure that impact the taxonomy. We will have to do some remodeling, some new elements, deprecate some elements, also some definition change, so some documentation labels will change. But that's the, you know, bad thing for us, that we have a lot to do. But the good thing is that those changes are non-controversial. So mostly the EISB is trying to align the IFRS for SMEs to full IFRS. Therefore, the modeling that we will use will be compliant with the full IFRS. The effective date will be 1st of January 2017. And the main amendments, a very quick run through, if I can see that at some point. Yeah. So the main changes are the separation of investment property accounted for using the cost model from property, plant, equipment. So previously, in SMEs, that investment property was part of property plan equipment and was accounted for, and the disclosures were together with the property plan equipment. Now it will be clearly separated. In addition, we are adding the option to revaluate property plan equipment, and that's the revaluation model, same model that is already in full IFRS, so nothing new. Also, in accordance with full IFRS, we are separating the OCI items into those that will and will not be reclassified, although in SMEs there are only, I think, four OCI items, so there will be three. Then there are three currently, there will be four, three will be reclassified one, not or the other way around, but not a hugely important change. A big change is the complete rewrite of the section for income tax. The current income tax section in SMEs was influenced by the exposure draft of IAS 12 changes that never got finalized. It was an exposure draft that was there in 2009 but never got finalized. And now we are aligning the whole section of for income tax to IAS 12 income taxes. So also there will be nothing that you don't know from the full IFRS. And there are also some minor amendments. There is an undue cost or effort exemption in IFRS for SMEs that will have a number of disclosures related to the use of that exemption. Also, similarly to full, there will be an equity method allowed in the separate financial statements. There will be also a permit to apply the Section 35, which is the equivalent of IFRS 1, multiple times, as well as amendments to some of the definitions. For example, combined and separate financial statements, related party, will also have some new definitions for items that were not, for terms that were not defined in IFRS for SMEs before. So as I said, this is currently now being balloted or in the post-ballot stage right prior to the publication. So it should be published in May, and we'll prepare the taxonomy update and share that with you probably end of May, I would do it. That would be my expectation. One thing I wanted to mention here, using the fact that we are changing the IFRS for SMEs, is the modularization issues. So you probably remember that in 2013, until 2013, we had one core schema. From 2013, we split the core schema, so now we have a separate full IFRS core schema and IFRS for SMEs core schema. This was done after a long discussion, and to be honest, I was one of the people that were actually against it, and I thought it's better to use the same elements because of the connection between full IFRS and IFRS for SMEs. But those changes to IFRS for SMEs actually show that it was probably better to separate them. These are two separate standards. Now we have no pressure to reuse the full IFRS elements. We can create the separate IFRS for SMEs elements where necessary. And I just wanted to show you a couple of illustrations of elements for which, you know, the fact that we can now differentiate between the label for IFRS for SME element and full IFRS is very important. So you can see the effect of transition to IFRSs and the effect of transition to IFRS for SMEs. So they do have a different meaning. They do carry a different meaning. It's a different thing to make a transition to IFRS, full IFRS and IFRS for SMEs. And now we can have actually two separate elements. Same with the IFRS and IFRS for SMEs compliance. So in the past, we were using the effect of transition to IFRS in SMEs, and we were explaining that for SMEs that actually refers to SMEs. But now we can have, you know, proper elements that are standalone elements. And also the changes in documentation labels. For example, for business combinations, you will see that there is a different definition of what a business combination is in full IFRS and IFRS for SMEs. Also for joint ventures, you will see that there's a different definition what a joint venture is between full and IFRS for SMEs. We struggled in the past having to choose one definition or trying to come up with a general definition, put two in one. Now we have separate elements. Each of those elements can have a separate definition. So I think that proves that we made the right choice last year when we decided to separate full IFRS from IFRS for SMEs. Any questions on that, Luis?
Do they have different prefixes?
Yes.
In the taxonomy, yes.
So they
could have shared labels and things and had two labels for the same item, but we thought that was way too confusing. Two elements is much clearer.
Well,
standard labels.
Yeah. Still a little confusing to me. I mean, so at least you've distinguished it by its namespace, right?
Yeah. And they're in separate files now. That was modernization. They're separate elements with separate namespaces.
But the element names are the same. The local names are the same.
Potentially, yes, although there's no requirement for it to be. And I see earlier conversations about local element names and codes and being semantically meaningful.
We would have had to deprecate all the elements, get rid of the same element names, but because they are in now different namespaces, then we thought it's not.
It just makes it, as far as we're concerned, a lot clearer. Even if we could have created duplicates on the single element, it's just much, much clearer having the non-duplicates.
I actually thought it might be useful to have the same element name, because in most cases, you know, assets are probably assets, and you know, it might be easier for people to compare if they had the same name.
Same name with the same prefix. And
no, with the same prefix it would be bad, but they have different prefixes.
And that's why the number of elements went from like 3,500 to 5,000 or 5,500.
Yeah, it was 1.2,000 elements for SMEs that got separated and increased.
Better watch out before you know it, you'll be as big as that.
I think that's it.
Okay. And so the last point is something that was on the agenda during our last face-to-face meeting, but we never got there. So we will get there today, since I can see that I have 15 minutes left. It's a question of early application of standards. It's a question of a disclosure. Most of the new IFRS or EISB publications, whether they are IFRS or amendments to IFRS, they include they all include an effective date and transition part, but in that section they often include a sentence that says if an entity applies this IFRS or this amendment to IFRS earlier, it shall disclose that fact. And in the IFRS taxonomy so far, we haven't had elements for that disclosure. We knew about it. We have left it intentionally untagged. And the reason why first the example actually. So that's an example from an actual IFRS financial statement of a group that says we have early adopted the IFRS 10, 11, 12, and then as a result of that, what happened? So that's how that disclosure would look like in an actual IFRS financial statement, or might look like in an IFRS financial statement. Why we haven't had separate tags for that is because we believed, and we still believe, that these disclosures are already covered by other IFRSs. And in the year of the initial application, it's covered by IS 828, which says that when an entity has initially applied an IFRS or an amendment to an IFRS by analogy, it should disclose the title, it should disclose the change in the accounting policy, it should disclose whether it's made in accordance with the transitional provisions, and should describe those transitional provisions. So in the first year of application, we thought that would cover it. The way it's modeled in the taxonomy is we have a table, and you can use the members to say which IFRS or which amendment to an IFRS you are talking about, and then you have all those A, B, C, D elements, line items, so the title and then description of the nature and description of transitional provisions and so on. In the next years, we believe these disclosures are covered in general by IS-1, which requires you to disclose the accounting policies that are relevant to understanding the financial statements. And we believe such an accounting policy is relevant to understanding the financial statements, in particular when there is an early adoption, early application possible. And we have text block elements for accounting policies, so we believe that would be also covered by those text blocks. And the question, therefore, is, do you think that those disclosures are enough, are sufficient to represent the disclosure of the early application of an IFRS or an amendment to an IFRS? Or should we still consider separate text elements? And one other note I would like to make is that they would be text elements. So the fact whether they would be tagged or not also depends, obviously, on the regulator and the use and the rules, tagging rules. So in the US, they would remain untagged anyway. So I'll stop there with the first question before, because the second question might be moot. Luis?
So you're using the dimension initially applied IFRS axis with the single member, right? Initially applied IFRS.
Yeah, we expect extension members.
What is the extension member going to do?
Well, it will say IFRS 10, IFRS 11, IFRS 12, whichever IFRS is early applied.
So the dimension is telling you it's early applied. And then the member's telling you which one.
Yeah.
Is that not also conveyed in the line items or no? Maybe not.
Well, if you take the element description of change in an accounting policy, it's not necessarily. But
okay. You answered my question.
Is it easy to find out that this is an early application if we just use IAS 1, that disclosure?
Well, it's not that easy. I mean, definitely it's easier in the first year when you have that, when you
right.
have that table. In That's the future years, we believe it's a part of the accounting policy. So if you look at the accounting policy, you will see it there. But it's not currently separated. So it would be part of an accounting policy, but not necessarily a separate element, which actually might play as an advantage in case the US scenario is adopted, because there is a requirement to tag accounting policies separately. So if it is part of an accounting policy, the text will get tagged. If it's a separate text item in the US, there would be no requirement to tag it.
With a level one?
Yeah.
Text
well,
line?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the accounting policies.
Yeah, level
two. Is
right.
So there might be a slight advantage in case a similar to US system would be used, which I'm not saying it's often used. But, yeah.
So what I'm asking is some maybe investors or some regulators. Maybe they would like to know clearly whether this company is an early adoption of some specific standard, rather than looking at the old accounting knowledge choice and the disclosure. So it will take some maybe 10 seconds, maybe more, to find out. But if you just start having a specific separate tab for this early application, maybe then investors, this company is quite peculiar, in adopting this standard quite early, rather than. Because those companies are very small in terms of numbers, basically. So that is a kind of a signal information about this company, whether there is specific some secrets or some performance. So that's why I'm saying if we are going to provide some efficiency, then maybe.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why we're asking this question publicly, exactly to know what are the opinions of the group. If you're suggesting we should reach out to some other people outside this group, we would be happy to. I see no problem in us doing that. If you have any ideas, to whom to speak.
I think from an investor viewpoint, because I come from a data aggregator viewpoint, like Bartek and I discussed that question quite a lot. And I think from the first time, so even the company first declares that they have applied a standard, that is captured in our taxonomy very clearly. In the second year, it's not captured very well. So then you have to ask the question, okay, in the second year, are you going to impose a cost on the preparer to retake that information, or can you reasonably assume that the investors has received that information in the first place and the company is not going to change in the second year? So from a data aggregator viewpoint, and I also asked this question to Morningstar, it's like, okay, once you have that information is provided to you in the first time, you can store that information in your database so that it is extrapolated to future years. Now, so therefore, the user has to do a small additional cost to continue to process the data, the benefit of it is that the preparer doesn't have to have an additional complex tagging in the second year. So that's where looking cost benefits, maybe the approach we have taken is the right approach, but it's definitely something where we can do more outreach on still.
I also think that to the extent that you've early adopted, and during that period from when an early adoption is possible up until a standard is required, in effect you're in the same position as having options under IFRS as to how you can apply a particular measurement or whatever the standard's providing. So you're the same position as being able to apply IFRS in one way or another way at that point. And so therefore, if we were going to require separate presentation in this scenario, I think it would mean that we would have to provide a separate presentation where IFRS enables an option of one or the other. Though I think actually
maybe it's an accounting policy.
It's an accounting policy and it's an option. And now we're doing some work on accounting policies anyway at the moment to work out exactly what is a significant accounting policy that should be disclosed separately. But I would think if we were going to do one here, we would make sure it was consistent with the others. But actually thinking about it, I do think maybe the standards where they enable that option do require separate disclosure of that option.
I think we'll find that. And again, once you have captured that information in the first place, it's okay, I think.
Louis?
Oh. I thought you were reading my mind now. I actually do. I'm just continuing to fixate on this. I imagine there are multiple modeling choices on this that you puzzled through. Why wouldn't you provide the various members here? Don't you know what the new accounting standards are?
We could. I mean, we would have probably quite a long list. But
well, you don't have to keep them forever, though, right?
Yeah.
That's what we do with our ASU members. We add them every year as we have new ones, and they drop off in theory over time. But
we could. I mean, we would have to have members for each amendment that carries the same text. So there would be a lot of them because it's not only about the new standard, which is easy, but it's about each amendment to a standard.
Yeah.
So you know, it might be that certain application of a standard, certain standard also amends the others, and that there would be a question how to
like an extended
that. Plus,
I have a bit of paper that says that.
plus, you have say IFRS 10, 11, 12. Someone might say 10 to 12. Someone might say 10 only.
That would be a great type dimension. All right.
It's not the best, it's not the easiest to do with the explicit dimensions, let me just say that, without saying the other.
Any more for you?
Nope, that's it. Told you I'm going to make it.
Great.
I got a thank you slide.
That's pretty cool.
Good point, come on.
Yeah. You gotta wait for it, but